You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you like technology and looking for buried treasure, geocaching might be the hobby for you. Learn more about the outdoor activity and a big geocaching event coming up this weekend in Wisconsin.
First, President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un traded threats of violence yesterday, escalating the war of words between the two nations.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Hours after these comments, North Korea threatened to strike Guam, the Pacific island where the U.S. has an important Air Force base.
Jeremy Suri is a professor in the Department of History and holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His new book is coming out in September, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, many times over the years, there have been opportunities to talk about tensions between North Korea and the United States. Is this a particularly worrisome moment?
This is the most worrisome moment in my lifetime. We have a North Korean leader who has shown a willingness to ratchet up what were already tensions between our two countries and to pursue nuclear capabilities that could actually reach the United States. At the same time, we have an American president who is speaking more explicitly about using nuclear weapons in response to North Korea than any president has before. So I would say this is a chilling moment and the most dangerous moment, I think, of any crisis in my lifetime.
Let's look at both sides of that one at a time. What do you make of the latest developments in North Korean missile technology? Missiles, warheads, maybe not warheads that can survive long-range strikes, ones that would require going into space and back into the atmosphere, but still potentially serious threats there.
Yes, I mean, the relatively young North Korean leader has clearly made it a priority above everything else, including feeding his own population, to develop not just a nuclear capability, but a capability of hitting the United States. And his goal is not to be accurate, not to try to pinpoint areas, but to be able to threaten us with massive casualties for Americans if we in any way threaten his regime. And he has been remarkably successful. By most estimates, within the next year, he'll be able to launch some kind of device that would hit somewhere on the West Coast, if not even farther in the interior of the United States. That's really scary.
And on the American side, we heard what President Trump had to say. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson maybe dialing down those comments a little bit. Here's a listen.
North Korea's rhetoric has just ratcheted up louder and louder and more threatening. So I think what the president was doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language.
So this is just a strong language that maybe can get through to a leader who doesn't speak the normal language of diplomacy. Is there something to that, Jeremy?
No, that's absolute nonsense. Kim Jong-un has very clearly understood what our policy has been. We have been pursuing a policy that has combined non-military sanctions and preventive measures, attempts to, even through cyber means, undermine his nuclear project. And at the same time, we've used force to deter him from using his nuclear weapons and conventional weapons in any way. That's why we have forces in South Korea. That's why we have forces in Japan and elsewhere. The kind of language that President Trump used is the kind of bullying language I was used to hearing as a kid in New York City. And all that does is encourage the other side to threaten back at an even greater rate. Deterrence, effective deterrence, has always relied upon credibility and consensus. And you don't have credibility when you shoot off your mouth in response to North Korea in the way the president did, nor do you build consensus with your allies. Imagine how the Japanese and the South Koreans and the Taiwanese feel when they hear the president talking that way, without consulting them, by the way, first, without consulting his own advisors. So I think Tillerson, Secretary of State Tillerson, is trying to put a positive gloss on what were some terribly damaging words used by the president of the United States.
Now, even short of the use of nuclear weapons by North Korea, or for the United States for that matter, I think there's pretty widespread agreement that even a conventional war, if it broke out, along the South Korea-North Korea border would be really quite disastrous. Can you talk about what we might be fearing there?
Well, so the main reason that the United States, since the late 90s, has not taken military action to stop North Korea from pursuing its nuclear and missile projects is because of just what you pointed out, Rob, because of the conventional threat to South Korea. The Clinton administration in the late 90s considered taking military action. They could have stopped North Korea from developing even the beginnings of a nuclear weapon, but they knew that North Korea would respond by killing millions of people in South Korea with conventional weapons, which are prepared for that purpose. Seoul is quite close to the border and easily reachable by very primitive North Korean conventional capabilities. The North Koreans have tunneled under the demilitarized zone. There are all sorts of things they've done to bring mass casualties to the South. That would still happen in any conflict today. So that's why there aren't any good options, because any kind of military effort we take, even if it limits the nuclear capabilities the North Koreans have developed, they will still have conventional capabilities to cause death on a very large scale in a very important part of the world. South Korea is one of the largest economies in the world. So this would be a humanitarian and an economic disaster.
Jeremy Suri is with us from the University of Texas Austin, looking at U.S.-North Korea relations, tensions ratcheting up to a very high level, the highest he says he has seen in his lifetime between the two countries. A common statement about North Korea is, Jeremy, there is no good policy when it comes to North Korea. Is that true? Is there a right way to approach North Korea?
Well, I think there isn't a silver bullet, but most difficult policy issues, if you look at the Middle East, if you look at other regions, don't have silver bullet solutions. I think the most effective mechanism right now begins with maintaining unity among all of our allies and continuing to use sanctions and deterrence. So trying every way we can to limit the access to materials, to resources that the North Korean regime has for their project, and making it clear to them that it's not just the United States, but that all the countries in the region, including China, will take strong military action if the North Koreans do anything that leads to the deaths of Americans or deaths of South Koreans or others. So a combination of deterrence and non-military coercion is probably the best we can do. But when we shoot off our mouths and say we're going to bring fire and fury, it's very hard to maintain that consensus and keep our allies working with us.
We just saw the United Nations Security Council vote to impose these new sanctions on North Korea. That presumably means that China and Russia didn't block those. That's kind of a big diplomatic step. What do you see as the impact of these sanctions?
Well, these new sanctions would make it very, very difficult for the North Korean leader to get access to many of the things he likes, and it would make it even harder for the North Koreans to get cash from abroad. They use citizens who work in China and elsewhere to remit cash, hard currency, to them that they then use to buy products that they need for their military projects and other things. And this will make it harder for them. But the key question, Rob, is enforcement. In the past, we've had strong sanctions in place, but the Russians and the Chinese have allowed the North Koreans to cheat. They're going to have to be tougher. We're going to have to use diplomacy to encourage them to enforce these sanctions. And that's where the role of the State Department and the role of our diplomats is so crucial.
People have been pointing out that the State Department has been slow to appoint some key diplomats, including an ambassador to South Korea, though I understand some people have said, well, it's okay, our embassy in South Korea is in good hands. What do you make of the role of the State Department and where it is right now?
Well, I think anyone who has talked to anyone at the State Department now would tell you it's an absolute chaos. It's not simply that Secretary Tillerson has not appointed major figures. It's also that the State Department is not involved in policymaking. They don't know what the policy is. One of the real damaging effects of having a leadership structure right now that lurches from one position to another and says three different things on the same day is that it's very hard for diplomats to know what it is they're trying to negotiate for. What is the goal they're seeking? What are their purposes when they meet with their foreign counterparts? And everyone I've talked to at the State Department, and this includes people who are Republicans, they're sort of out of the loop right now. And that makes it very hard for us to manage our relations, particularly with our allies, the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Taiwanese. These are very important relationships. relationships. And not having an ambassador means that we're not prepared to manage those relationships.
I think the worst case people are worried about now is that we stumble into some kind of hot conflict here with conventional weapons, maybe even nuclear weapons, each side fearing the hostile intentions of the other. What kind of steps can we take from the United States side of things to prevent something like that from happening?
Well, this is a profound question you asked, Rob. The historian in me says that the majority of wars do not start because two countries decide to go to war with one another. That's the rarity. Actually, more often than not, countries stumble into wars. World War One is one of many historical analogies here. And I would remind listeners that the last North Korean missile test just a few days ago almost hit a civilian aircraft. There was a civilian aircraft very close that almost accidentally hit. And imagine what would have happened in that case. We almost went to war with the Soviet Union in 1983. We shot down a Korean airliner jet, some listeners might remember. So this is a real danger. And I would actually put the chances of us stumbling into war at above 25% right now. I mean, this is pretty significant. What measures should we take? We need to make sure, first of all, that we have our diplomats in place and we're able to talk. How do you avert an accident leading to war? You have open communications with adversaries as well as with allies. And second, we need to stop using street language from New York City and actually instead use careful language that's tailored to our purposes so people know what we believe, know where we stand, and know where our red lines are. Otherwise, people will misinterpret where we stand and will take actions that will lead us to go to war. So we have to be careful with our language, and we need far better diplomacy.
Briefly, as we wrap up, will those things? Are you hopeful that those measures will be taken?
I am somewhat hopeful because the clip you played from Secretary of State Tillerson indicated to me that he recognizes this and that he and Secretary of Defense Mattis and others are seeking to walk back some of the language and that they are reaching out to our allies. Secretary Tillerson was just in Asia. So I think what we've talked about here is not rocket science. It's stuff they understand. Many people around the president understand this. The question is going to be, can they get the administration as a whole, including the president of the United States, to play to the same sheet of music? Can they get everyone working in this direction? Because if they can't, then they're not going to be successful at averting disaster.
Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at the latest news in U.S.-North Korea relations after strong words from the leaders of both countries.